This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So if it looks like a bubble and floats like a bubble, is it a bubble? That's what New York Times writer Nick Bilton asks. Is there a technology bubble? Investors speculate that there is. Silicon Valley, of course, says not so. But seeing that Silicon Valley lives in a bubble of its own making, can you really believe them? Joining us to talk about the tech bubble and the Silicon Valley culture is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there again, Nancy Kane.
Hello there.
Well, reading these stories, I'm just worked up into a frenzy because these zillionaires are taking over, you know, this, not just the Silicon Valley, but moving into San Francisco and people, the story about the 98-year-old woman who's lived in a rent-controlled apartment for 50 years is going to lose it because somebody wants to put in some snazzy luxury apartments across the street. So tell us what this tech bubble is and what it's doing to San Francisco and the surrounding communities.
So what did Twain say? The past is not dead, it is not even past. So this is this story, right? New, very powerful, important industry with lots and lots and lots of wealth created primarily through equity, right? Through financial markets, and not that the products aren't important, et cetera, but the primary driver of the wealth is the financial market, the stock market. Think railroads in 1890. Think steel in Pittsburgh in 1885.
Oh, yeah.
Think Newport in 1890. Think about other very important new surging industries that have locational centers that then, in a sense, sweep over the landscape, own the culture, creating lots and lots and lots of different kinds of inequality, even in the wake of great wealth creation. I mean, there's no question inequality spiked dramatically at the income and wealth level, as best we can measure it in the late 19th century, around industries booming and busting like tech, like railroads or steel or the early automobile industries. So I don't think there's a brand new story here. I think it highlights for us, right, the extraordinary, if you will, costs of creative destruction, right? For all the glamour and sizzle of, you know, all the Silicon Valley, you know, millionaires, for all the glitter and vicarious interest we have in the kind of wealth shown on a movie like Social Network, there's another story. There's an underbelly. There's an underside. And that is what this Times article and many others, including this article by George Packer in The New Yorker in May, that caused all kinds of ire in Silicon Valley, they're writing about what's the other part of this story. And that's an important aspect of what's happening right now in places like Silicon Valley.
When you say the other part of the story, I hope part of what you're referring to is that these are the most self-important people I've ever read about in my life. When Mark Zuckerberg comes out as the most socially conscious person in the crowd, we'll talk about him in a few minutes. There's this Google employee, when Barack Obama goes out to speak at one of the campuses in Silicon Valley, a Google employee is quoted as saying, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not going to go to hear the president because what I do every day is affecting more important change than the president of the United States ever can. And by the way, that was not intended to be full of irony. This is what he and apparently a lot of his colleagues believe. This is not aberrational. You say this is history repeating itself.
I think if we could be in a smoke-filled room in one of J.P. Morgan's clubs, right, or on the Corsair, his great yacht in 1906, I think we'd hear some of the similar kind of things. You know, one of my favorite rockers, a kind of second tier but brilliant singer and lyricist, Pete Yorn, has a song called "Splendid Isolation," and these industries are characterized by, in quotes, "splendid isolation." These moments, and you know, we all have our villages and our tribes and things. But what we're talking about here is a little bit different because, you know, J.P. Morgan and his cronies, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, you know.
From Oracle, the highest paid CEO
in America for more than 1 year, right? All of these people have enormous power. That's what makes it different than my tribe of horseback riders or my tribe of, you know, historians. These people have enormous power, not just wealth, but power. And so I think, you know, what do we as a society think about the responsibility, if you believe indeed there is any, that accompanies that kind of authority, financial and cultural and technological and economic? And, you know, history is pretty clear on this. History is pretty clear that societies where those in great power have owned the responsibility as part of the authority, as the counterpart or the balance to the authority, have done much better in all kinds of measures on a sustainable basis than those in which that has not been the case. So I think the real issue, we're in some sense talking about less in the bubble case because, you know, your guess is as good as mine as to whether this is going to bust again. If you made me bet on it from a historical basis, I'd say yes. I mean, the railroads boomed and busted as a bubble industry, you know, 25 times between 1860 and 1885. And so why would we think that tech would be so much different? It really is, I think, a fair parallel. But that aside, I think this issue of what do those that, you know, end up with so much clout owe, if anything, I have my own personal sense of that. You know, what do they owe to the larger landscape, San Francisco, to the political process? I mean, most of these men that are quoted in the Packer article, and we're talking about men. This is not a diverse group
That's
of people.
That's a great point.
It's white men. It's white men. It's white men. Let me say it one more time. It's white men that we're talking about overwhelmingly in this world. What do they, in a sense, owe, right, to the polity?
Well, their answer would be, we don't know anything,
no,
because our work product is our gift or what we give to the rest of society. Other people through the ages have given different things, but we have no obligation because we've already met it. Isn't that what they'd say?
I think, you know, I think a lot of them do say that. I think there are some exceptions. There are some people that take the role, you know, even someone like Reid Hoffman at LinkedIn. I mean, he, or Mark Andreessen to some extent at Netscape and now at the venture capital firm that he runs that's so influential on Sand Hill Road. Some of these people think, you know, look, we've got an enormous amount of, you know, wind beneath our wings. What are we going to do with that? Not just for the specific aspects of policy that we think we want, like better visa policies for engineers, but also in a larger sense for educational standards in America, right? For job creation. I mean, Steve Jobs, you know, infamously said, Apple's not going to bring any of those jobs back from Asia. Well, Steve Jobs said that. There may come a time when Apple needs to sing a different chorus. But I don't think a lot of that the incentive for that will come from within this community of tribal chiefs. I think it's much more likely to come from voter and consumer pressure.
But the one outlier, at least, and I'm not, I don't know this industry at all, and surely not like you do, the one outlier seems to be the one from a different generation, namely Bill Gates. I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, whatever, has given, I guess, billions of dollars to education.
Well, Zuckerberg gave him $100 million.
Well, Zuckerberg's the one out right, when he was in real trouble, by the way, when he was taking a lot of heat. A lot of people think that was basically to mollify the critics.
Still a lot of money.
But is Bill Gates the outlier when it comes to, for example, just pick one example, public schools, where most of the kids of these Masters of the Universe don't go to school? Is he the outlier?
So I think, again, forgive me for being so harumphy historical, but I think it's a little early for us to kind of know this with any kind of certainty. So you think about someone like Andrew Carnegie, right, who did an extraordinary amount for education and libraries and communities and culture, right, after some little wee problems like the Homewood strike, right, and a lot of labor dispute. But it was a while before Carnegie stepped in. It was a while before Morgan and the second generation, really, of Rockefellers started to make a huge difference in terms of the betterment of mankind. I have had a number of different encounters with Melinda Gates, not on a one-on-one basis, but in small group settings. She and her husband, I have seen them close on in several different moments, are extraordinarily impressive. I have to say, just for what it's worth, that Bill Gates looks like a much happier, much more kind of centered person, giving away his money effectively, you know, in a very, very conscientious, careful, studied way. You know, this is one of the most results-oriented philanthropies in the world. I mean, he and she, because she's as much of the brains, if not more than he is, behind the Gates Foundation and their staff, they are going to eradicate certain illnesses for good. Because not just because they have the money, but because of the way that they're assembling people and other resources in very targeted, milestone measured kind of ways to make progress. So I think he's actually a front runner, if history is any guide, to, you know, a person and their responsibility and their resources trying to make a mark on a bigger canvas than what's the market cap of my company.
Well, also, how old is Bill Gates? He's in his 50s by now.
I think
now,
he's in his mid-50s.
Mid-50s, and Zuckerberg is what?
28, 27, something.
How about you mentioned the guy from Netscape. What has the guy from Netscape done? Has he done something?
So Mark Andreessen is, you know, is just a very active kind of spokesperson, and I would say, you know, kind of soup maker. He stirs up the broth and the vegetables in Silicon Valley around politics, around a larger footprint, around different kinds of possibilities for collective action other than who's going to invest in the next, in the second round for the next IPO.
Yeah.
Right. I think that Andreessen and some others as well show signs of, if you will, thinking beyond the transactional. I use that word very carefully. The transactional, right, pitter-patter and rhythm and culture and energy of Silicon Valley. So I spent time in Silicon Valley. Marjorie and I were saying we're Stanford graduates. You know, I've been back. It's an extraordinarily transactional place. You know, it really is. And if you ask people about art and culture and poetry, they'll tell you about it in relation to a technology, to an app, to a digitized collection, to something that is not always marketable, but always comprehensible, primarily in terms of its technological, right, application or connection, which is kind of fascinating when you think about it. It's like saying, going to Pittsburgh in 1879, everything being about the Bessemer process.
Do you know this Peter Shea guy? You're a much nicer person than I am, Nancy Kane. That's pretty obvious. Here's this. There's a startup founder named Peter Shea, S-H-I-H. And I guess he's the poster boy for bad behavior. He listed on a blog or something 10 things he hated about San Francisco, which is basically pricing out almost everybody because all of these young zillionaires are moving in. He hates homeless people. He hates constantly PMSing about the weather. And, quote, girls who are obviously fours and behave like they are nines. Convince me that he's the outlier. He's the aberration. Is he? I mean, the arrogance level in these pieces, the Packer piece in the New Yorker, some of these pieces in the New York Times, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but the level of arrogance and sense of self-importance is, to me, and again, you're the historian, is just, it's epic. It is nauseating. Is she an outlier?
I think we could probably parachute into some other places, you know, including parts of Cambridge, where we would, and I say that as someone, you know, as a long-term Cambridgian, right, where we would find similar levels of being obsessed with ourself and arrogance. What's troubling? Here's what's troubling to me, so forgive my old world piety. What's troubling is that a lot of these people have, and they know it, just like a lot of folks in Hollywood and a lot of folks in Washington, a lot of CEOs, have extraordinary, you know, influence and reach. So it's, you know, you say something and it is broadcast, or you say something and it is tweeted, or you say something and it ends up in a very prominent, you know, communication channel. So is that really, I want to ask, how you want to show up? You know, women are fours but act like they're nines. That's so condescending. It's so treating people like, you know, like they're some kind of means rather than another person.
But aren't they all saying they're fours? If what you say is true and there's so few women in the hierarchy of Silicon Valley, then it seems to me all these young leaders are saying the exact same thing by their actions. They're saying they're all fours when it comes to brain power and creativity. He's talking about their bodies and their faces. Everybody else is talking about their minds and their creativity. No?
I think we want to be careful about saying, you know, condescension and frat boy behavior, you know, is something that Silicon Valley has some kind of patent on. I just think we are living in a society in which common courtesy and communal respect is in short supply, you know. So I think that we want to be careful about that. Having said that, again, this along with Wall Street. So let's talk about it this way, folks. One step back, put on the wide-angle lens. These are the two industries that lead our economy. They don't literally lead our economy in terms of, like, stock market activity and wealth creation. They lead our economy in terms of the kind of cultural and even motivational influence they have. So think about how many young people today start talking about an IPO or selling something to Facebook. These are two huge Goliaths on the landscape. Is this what we want to hold them accountable for? To girls that act like they're nines when they're fours, I think we can do better than that.
You know, Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School, you were talking about before the comparison between, you know, the Vanderbilts, Carnegies, Rockefellers, and all those people that made enormous wealth earlier in our history. But one of the things that strikes me as different is because the wealth is spread around much more. You know, Twitter went public and six, you know, I think it was 1,000 millionaires or 1,600 millionaires were created and stuff like that. And people, you know, there was one Vanderbilt family, one Roosevelt, I mean, not Roosevelt, Rockefeller family, et cetera. And when you look at these, the impact of all this enormous wealth on a city like San Francisco or on a town like Palo Alto where we just lived, it is much bigger because there are many more millionaires.
Not in relative terms, though, Marjorie. So think about Harkness Commons, which is a very famous building in the Harvard Law School. It's built by Stephen Harkness. Stephen Harkness was one of those folks who was part of the, if you will, the analog of the Standard Oil IPO. Or think about South Florida. South Florida was largely created by millionaires that were made by Standard Oil. So the most common moment to compare this to, the one closest in rough kind of hue, is this amazing tech bubble of the late 19th century. Newport, right?
Okay.
You know, parts of Connecticut. Parts of New York. Think about what Fifth Avenue was. Fifth Avenue was a countryside, right? Remember Age of Innocence, that movie?
Yes,
the movie
I
with
loved
Daniel Day-Lewis? And like they went to visit Granny and she was like at like West 57th and, you know, Central Park West. And there was nothing around her. She was in the country, right? So that was all populated by the equivalent of Twitter IPO millionaires. So yes, we've had those before. And in relative terms, I'm sure we don't have more wealth creation on a per capita basis than we did then. But what's interesting is just like then, perhaps even more so now, that wealth is actually very inequitably, very tightly distributed among a very tiny percent. So I just looked up income inequality, some very, very good numbers. So in 2012, according to the IRS, this is income, not stock market asset, right, creation, asset value. In 2012, the top 1% controlled like 24% of all income, a quarter of all the income made in the United States.
Wow.
We're just living in a time that is of extraordinary consolidation of money, both stocks and flows, you know, wealth and income in the hands of a very few people. So you add that to the kind of things we're talking about culturally, and we have something that suggests to me that it's not socially, culturally, you know, sustainable or stable.
Okay, we only have 2 minutes left. I want you to explain something to me. I know you're an historian, but you're at Harvard Business School, so I know you can explain this. Let's talk about just one company, because Marjorie started this discussion with, you know, is this tech bubble going to burst? And obviously a lot of people who have mutual funds whatever hope it doesn't. Snapchat. Let's just take that as an example. Snapchat, for those who don't know, is that, you know, you send the video pictures and they disappear in whatever X number of seconds or whatever it is. Okay. Snapchat was valued at $70 million 8 months ago. Today, you know what it's valued at now, 8 months later? $4 billion. Do you know how much revenue it has? Zero.
Yeah.
Could you, now in 60 seconds or less, could you please explain, or 140 characters if you prefer, could you explain to me how its valuation went from $70 million to $4 billion and how we're not at risk of a bubble bursting as a result of this kind of thing?
I can explain the first, but can't promise you the second.
Okay, fine. Take
so
what
the
I
first
get.
Is that in the intervening months, right, the market, partly because of Twitter, partly because of some other interesting and Facebook's recovery, the market for young technology company equity, assets in those companies, ownership, whether they're public or private, you can still invest in companies, right, has gotten very hot. Let's put it that way. So it's a little bit like when Vamp, you know, nail polish made by Chanel in the 90s got really popular and you couldn't buy it anywhere and the price went way up. Same kind of thing. So suddenly people will pay a lot more for a piece of paper that says you own one share of Snapchat, you know, stock in a private company. You can still buy, you know, preferred and common stock than they would 6 months ago. It's just like that. It's not about some kind of carefully calibrated cost-benefit analysis of the likelihood of this company making P-R-O-F-I-T. It's about a market with lots and lots of people trying to get in that's as much about fashion and sizzle and sensibilities. Keynes called it animal spirits as it is about anything else.
Okay, fine. You know what I'll do, because you're such a good person, thus I will not ask you whether or not I should continue to keep my money under my mattress. We'll save that for next week. Is that fair enough?
Fair enough.
Now, Nancy Kane, it is a favor to you, since you mentioned what your favorite song was. We're going to go out on it. Nancy King, great to see you. We'll see you next week.
Oh, this is great. It's called Splendid, I believe. Is that what
Splendid
it's called?
Isolation. Sexiest rocker in the United States, Pete Yorn.
Okay. Nancy King is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership.